Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touchtone phone. And as a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would now like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Senior Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Dr. Messner, please go ahead.
Oh, thank you so much, Krista, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect Education Workshop. And today's workshop is being done in collab in partnership with the CLL Society Inc., and we are delighted to have them on the call today. You'll be hearing more about this wonderful organization. It is the only organization in the country that is specific to chronic lymphocytic leukemia, so I think that will be a really a very nice thing for everybody to learn more about this organization. And this is part three of Life with Chronic Lymphocytic Leukemia, so there will be a part four, and during the Q&A I'll let you know about that as well. Today's program is supported by AbbVie, a contribution from Lilly, and an educational grant from Johnson & Johnson Healthcare Systems, Inc. I really want to thank them for the support of today's program. And I just would like to say a few comments about all of the participants on the call today. We have over 200 participants on this program today, and you come from all of the United States, from both urban, rural, suburban, and frontier communities. And we also have international participants from Belgium, British Columbia, Canada, Israel, Philippines, South Africa, and the United Kingdom. So this is a global call, and we're delighted to have so many of you on the call today and from different parts of the world. That's just terrific. And happy that you've chosen to spend the next hour with us to learn more about these issues. And now it is my great pleasure to introduce our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Michael Choi, and Dr. Choi is Associate Clinical Professor, Division of Hematology Oncology, UC San Diego Medical Center and Morris Cancer Center. And Dr. Choi will be addressing an overview of chronic lymphocytic leukemia, caring for your loved one with CLL, and your important role in decision making. It is my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Choi.
Well, thank you, Dr. Messner, and thank you, everyone, for the opportunity and the privilege to be a part of this program. I'm sure I will learn a lot from this discussion as well. So start by going over some of the basics of this diagnosis, chronic lymphocytic leukemia, or CLL. I'm sure many of you are very familiar with it already, but I think it's always helpful to go over some of the main aspects of this too. So as you know, chronic lymphocytic leukemia is a cancer of the white blood cells, specifically of a type of white blood cell called a lymphocyte or a B cell. All of us normally have these B cells or lymphocytes, but we normally our immune system just makes them and makes a diverse population of these cells just when needed. But with chronic lymphocytic leukemia, the theory or the what's happening is that one of these cells is starting, somehow gets mutated or starts to make copies of itself and then starts to accumulate. These cells then accumulate in the bloodstream, so we see that the white blood cell number or the absolute lymphocyte number goes up. These cells can accumulate in lymph nodes, so people can have swollen nodes on their neck or underarms or in their groin or elsewhere. And these cells also accumulate in the bone marrow. When they accumulate to too high a degree in the bone marrow, it can lead to problems producing normal blood cells, so people can become anemic and have based on having a low hemoglobin, or people could have low platelet counts, and that can lead to more bruising or risk of bleeding. But in many cases, people diagnosed with CLL can be completely asymptomatic. In fact, it's very common for somebody to be diagnosed as a totally incidental finding when blood tests are being done for other reasons. Somebody might be getting their annual physical or might be getting blood tests done before before a knee surgery, and lo and behold, the high white blood cell count is found. I can certainly see how in that setting it's surprising, almost shocking, to go into an office feeling healthy, being healthy, and then suddenly be told that you have this blood cancer. On top of that, it's often the case where that treatments are not initially recommended to treat this. So it must be, I imagine that it's difficult to hear that one has a cancer but isn't going to be treated for it, at least not initially. I guess the basis for that is that CLL can be stable and be asymptomatic for many, many years. In some cases, it could be 5 or 10 or 15 or 20 years almost. A person can still be just as healthy as they were before they knew they had this diagnosis. In those cases, it does not make sense to start medications that could bring in some side effects or some risk. But in other cases, if symptoms are starting to develop, then there are very effective treatments being developed that can reduce those symptoms. I'll go over those symptoms just briefly. Some of the common symptoms might be if the CLL is starting to become more aggressive or become to accumulate more, it could cause symptoms that resemble the flu. So people have things like sweats or weight loss or fatigue. And these things don't get better in just a few days like the flu normally does, but kind of persist and go on for several days or several weeks. If that's the case, certainly let your doctors know that you have these unexplained flu-like symptoms, and that can often be a sign that CLL treatment should be started. Other symptoms can be if those lymph nodes maybe go from being noticeable to being bothersome or being a size that's unwanted. Sometimes people feel aches or feel discomfort on the nodes if they're too large. One particular organ that can get enlarged is also the spleen. The spleen is kind of, I think of it as just a large lymph node in the abdomen, although that's probably an oversimplification. But the spleen is an organ that sits right next to the stomach on the left side of the abdomen. So if CLL cells are accumulating there and causing the spleen to grow, the person will feel a sense of fullness in their abdomen and sometimes describe a sense that they can't eat as much as they normally did. People say things like, it feels like I've eaten Thanksgiving dinner, but I've only had a few bites of food. I suppose that reference is more relevant to our listeners in the U.S. But that early satiety could be a sign that the CLL is getting worse and would benefit from treatment. That treatment could improve that symptom. And finally, sometimes the reason to treat is more numeric. The blood work is showing that the red cell count, the anemia, is getting to become more significant, or the platelet count is causing a more measurable risk of bleeding or bruising, and then that would be the thing that triggers the initiation of treatment. I suppose, as I mentioned earlier, not everyone will have these symptoms come up at the same rate or even to the same degree. So I think that's the importance of having a team, you and your loved one, communicating changes or symptoms with your medical team so that it can be decided together when the right time is to start one of these medications. So I was kind of reflecting on, based on that, how can you help? What help can a caregiver bring to this team? I suppose a few things I want to emphasize, and a lot of this is based on my, over the last month or so, kind of polling some of my patients and their loved ones of things that they wished they had learned earlier or could communicate to others. I guess the first thing is that, as I mentioned earlier, having CLL sometimes causes symptoms that might not be so visible or might not be so apparent to friends or loved ones. These can include some of the aches or flu-like symptoms, but it can also include non-physical symptoms, things like anxiety or worry. Surveys done through the CLL Society earlier showed that when patients were diagnosed with CLL, their worries were specifically about how this diagnosis might affect their loved ones or might affect their families. So certainly kind of having that open dialogue can help. Then more than that, I guess, people depend on having or benefit from having loved ones around them to help. None of us are meant to kind of go through life without help. And so sometimes that help can be just very logistical, helping with transportation to and from meetings, helping to organize medications, helping to report side effects or symptoms to the medical team. But I think that help can also be in terms of kind of talking about symptoms, talking about preferences, talking about priorities. A lot of times, because there are becoming more and more treatment options, your doctors, your medical teams will kind of ask you what treatments you might prefer most. Kind of having thought through that with your loved ones, I think could be a helpful way to help decide which treatment makes the most sense for you. I suppose in broad terms, that there are treatments that are meant to be taken on a daily basis as daily pill treatments. But these are intended to be taken sometimes for many years. In fact, there are some trials where people have been doing well on them for even 10 years and counting. But they come with mild side effects, things like diarrhea or risk of high blood pressure or risk of irregular heart rhythms. For some patients, the preference is to take this pill on a daily basis, knowing that it's controlling the disease and controlling the symptoms. There are other treatments that are designed more to be given for 1 or 2 years and then stopping, and then kind of going back to a watching mode, watching for the return of CLL. And for other patients, that being done with treatment, not taking medications during that remission period is also a very important priority. It does mean potentially being a little bit busier with appointments and infusions during that treatment time. And it could, for some patients, mean having to kind of worry about when things might come back when they're off treatment. So there is no wrong or right. It's kind of what fits best with each individual patient and their loved ones. So I think starting to think through those decisions, through what factors are most important to you, that'll help when it comes time to make a decision about treatment with your team. I guess I'll stop there, but certainly as we get to some of the question and answers, I could discuss things that we can clarify.
Thank you so much, Dr. Choi. That was really an outstanding presentation. And since you are the first speaker, you kind of set the stage really for the whole program and have given people a lot of information to think about. And I know there will be questions for you during the Q&A, so thank you so much. Thank you very much. And our next speaker is Dr. Guadalupe Palos, and Dr. Palos is former Clinical Protocol Administration Manager, Office of Cancer Survivorship, the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center, author and researcher in healthcare disparities, caregiving, and survivorship. And Dr. Palos will be addressing taking on the role of caregiving, challenges in communicating with the healthcare team, your role in adherence, weekends, holidays, and vacations, and coping with each day on special occasions, anniversaries, and birthdays. It is my great pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Palos.
All of our listeners, and thank you, Dr. Messner, for the opportunity to participate on this call on caring for a loved one with CLL. And I'd like to thank Dr. Choi for his for building a strong foundation for today's discussion. He provided an excellent update on CLL as a disease and the importance of shared decision-making. So I'll add to those comments throughout my presentation. But before we go in any further, I'd like to ask our listeners to join me in a quiet self-reflection. So just you don't have to give any answers or anything. Just close your eyes and picture all the caregivers you have known in your life. Did you ever wonder how that caregiver accepted that role? Did you ever wonder if that caregiver had a choice on making the decision to accept the roles, responsibilities, expectations, and engagement in this role? sometimes, we'll talk a little bit about that. Sometimes people are thrust into this role as a caregiver without any preparation. And sometimes people know that they are a caregiver because they've been doing it with others, and well, they'll just carry it on with this. But it, we'll talk a little bit about why that is so important, whether or not someone had a had some choice in making that decision, because it'll affect the entire caregiver experience. One of the things that's really key, and I bet you'll remember that as you're thinking of your caregiver, is communication. Research indicates that effective communication between patients, family, caregivers, and healthcare teams must begin with a cancer diagnosis is made. Why? Because this disease is complex, it varies across the entire experience, and involves many healthcare team members representing diverse professions and specialties. The interaction of all these factors can impact communication and eventually patient outcomes. Yet cancer patients encounter challenges in communicating openly with their providers. One reason is that every individual has unique communication needs and preference that will vary throughout the cancer journey. Poor communication between the healthcare team, patients, and caregivers can lead to problems such as a lack of exchanging important clinical information, which can lead to misdiagnosis, medical errors, or adverse events. Open and clear and honest communication between the patient and caregiver and the healthcare team can improve patient safety, patient satisfaction, and clinical outcomes. Now remember, communication depends on each person's preferred style. And there's three people, really, that are groups of people we're speaking of: the patient, their caregiver or caregivers, and their providers. So communication can be challenging when cultures, languages, and education and other personal characteristics differ among all the team members. Other factors affecting communication are the communication channels. That is it going to be are you having communication face-to-face, by a telephone, via Zoom call, or another form of our telemedicine? Communication is critical at the beginning and during the treatment phase, as well as the long-term survivorship journey. So remember, effective communication helps to optimize collaboration and coordination of care, and most important, decision-making, or shared decision-making. When patients and caregivers are actively involved in the care, it increases the likelihood that patients will follow their treatment schedule, their symptom management regimen, which can all promote better clinical outcomes. So before I go any further, I'm just going to highlight a few points of how to communicate with your healthcare team. First, remember that your healthcare team can help you understand your schedule and its importance and the disease. They can also offer solutions when barriers block your ability to understand the treatment, understand the regimen, understand the treatment schedule, or the side effects. That's number one. The second method is the most important one in helping you and your caregivers feel empowered, feel like you have some control over your treatment, and help patients and their families to advocate for themselves. I am talking about patients and caregivers, self-management, engagement, and education. I encourage patients, caregivers, and family members to learn about the medications, the disease, and its treatment. Learning about side effects is important so you can recognize them when they occur. Many side effects are temporary, so be sure and ask your team about the difference between short-lived and more long-term side effects with any of the medication. So I'd like to move on to talk a bit about taking on the role of the caregiver, which is today's all about, and I thank you all for participating in that exercise. Because of time restrictions, I'm not going to list all the duties and responsibilities of a caregiver. I'm quite positive that many, if not all of our listeners, are living that experience right now. And I want to remind you that Cancer Care has a booklet and has a lot of publications talking about communication as well as the disease of CLL. And Mr. Coffin will most likely go over the resources available from CLL as well as Ms. Smith. I'd like to remind our listeners that in today's call, we refer to a caregiver as an unpaid person who provides physical, practical, and emotional care and support to cancer patients. We often hear the term caregiver when discussing healthcare providers or paid caregivers, but that is a separate group and requires another teleconference. Few people plan to take on the role of a family caregiver, yet each year many Americans find themselves shouldering the responsibility of caring for a loved one diagnosed with cancer. And sometimes people find themselves caring for more than one person at the same time. With thoughtful planning, a strong support system, and a realistic understanding of the role, family caregivers can give their loved ones the help they need without sacrificing their health and sanity. So we need to know how caregivers can manage care during special events, such as birthdays, special occasions, and other types of events. They want to do that so you can provide effective care and minimize disruptions in the whole treatment and the medication schedule. So as providers, we must understand this disease's impact on families during these special events and support them during this time. As we have heard, many caregivers often feel that they have to maintain many roles at one time and yet still have a normal life. This becomes particularly important, again, when it's time to celebrate special times and maintain family cultural traditions. So how does a caregiver do that? Caregivers and families often find themselves struggling to keep up with these activities. So let me just first talk about how to cope with holidays and special events. Remember, first you and your family can create new traditions. For example, if you cannot be there in person, or, you know, you can always be creative and find some other ways, and I'll go through those in just a moment. Also, if your role was to be the family event planner or the queen or king chef, this is a good time to share that role or hand over the torch to another member of the family. Remember, it can be especially trying and stressful to be the event planner, the cook, the caregiver, the navigator, and so on. The beginning of summer vacations and other significant milestones, such as the birthdays and anniversaries, can raise awareness of the challenges and opportunities available to patients, caregivers, and their families. So here's another way that might be helpful. Many of you have been experiencing all the rain we're having, and on Texas, on the southeast side, we have a lot of hurricanes. We're very lucky to have those. So we all develop a hurricane preparedness plan. So one helpful strategy is to develop a special occasion preparedness plan. This plan, again, would be similar to the hurricane plan and map out how to prepare for those special events. The plan would allow the caregiver to make some trade-offs in their roles when caring for a loved one during special times, especially when they're far away from the caregiver. A few tips to remember in your plan is to be proactive and prepared, of course. Determine what can be realistically done. Don't try to create things that are going to be even more stressful. Create a stable and realistic role, and that's going to be even more important if you're a long-distance caregiver. And again, as I mentioned earlier, you can create new traditions. So, like, for example, instead of a big group gathering, you may consider making a point of smaller gatherings so your loved one can talk with individuals. Remember, those symptoms may interfere with them wanting to get involved with people or speak to people. If your loved one is restricted to one area, make that area the focal point of the celebration so they may feel more included. So, these moments are perfect times to bring out the old videos or photos of previous celebrations, including all types, okay, not just making it to the holiday that you're celebrating. You can also wish to do some storytelling about the good old times, and this is a great way to include children, adolescents, and adults. Everyone will have a special memory of a treasured event that they had. And you can use the social media, such as FaceTime, Skype, Zoom, and other similar ones, to communicate with each other. The other thing that happens during these times is travel. So remember, when flying, or if flying, keep your medication with you on a small carry-on. Yeah, and this is important at times to remember not to check in your medication bag. Keep it in the bag or your purse or your luggage that's going to go on the plane with you, and show it to the security folks when and if needed. So remember, the key thing is to plan and give yourself plenty of time to refill prescriptions and other medications. And again, give yourself plenty of time to plan all of this, because things seem to happen on those weekends, on those holidays, or the special events, and when traveling. So again, in summary, I'd just like to say it's clear that communication during the cancer experience is complex and subjective. The healthcare environment is a dynamic setting with multiple and diverse healthcare professionals and team members, and plenty of technical, scientific, and clinical information. So remember, clear, effective, and regular and open communication between your healthcare team and your caregivers can reduce caregiver burden, meet information needs, empower patients and their caregivers, and improve quality of life. My colleagues and I look forward to hearing from you or any suggestions you may want to share about how you coped with the holidays or what you thought about the role of a caregiver. And I thank you very much for allowing me to share these thoughts with you. Dr. Messner, I turn the program back over to you. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Palos. That was just a wonderful presentation, a stellar presentation, and actually you've given the participants a lot to think about, and you've also invited them during the Q&A to give suggestions that have worked for them as well. So we hope some of you will do that as well. Thank you so much. And I know there'll be questions for you also, Dr. Palos, during the Q&A. And our next speaker is Ms. Dina Smith, and Ms. Dina Smith is an oncology social worker at Cancer Care. She's our caregiver program coordinator at Cancer Care, and she'll be discussing managing family, friends, and traditions, long-distance caregiving, and practical self-care tips for managing stress. It's really my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Smith.
Thank you, Dr. Messner. So I want to start out by asking everyone to think about what caregiving looks like for them. So caregiving can look, feel, and mean different things for different people. Some people are short-distance caregivers. Maybe you are in the same household as your loved one, or maybe you just live across town, or maybe you identify as a long-distance caregiver, where maybe you live across state, across the country, or in completely different countries. You could be a child to your loved one battling cancer, a spouse, or even a parent. You may provide more emotional caregiving, such as a shoulder to cry on or a hug, or practical caregiving, like transporting your loved one to and from doctor's appointments or administering medication. There is no right or wrong way to be a caregiver, and remember that any effort that you are putting into the caregiving process is definitely more than enough. Each type of caregiving comes with its own stressors, of course. Your relationship with your loved one may change. Your daily responsibilities or priorities may change. Your annual traditions and get-togethers may look different. You may experience symptoms of burnout, such as fatigue, sleep changes, weight, appetite fluctuations, sadness, loneliness, anxiousness, and so much more. But remember, there are so many ways to alleviate stress. Carve out time for yourself each and every day, and if not every day, at least once a week. Be prepared and organized. Ask your oncologist questions, write down appointments, reach out to friends and family members for assistance or advice. Exercise, eat healthy. Seek counseling, whether it's individual counseling, group counseling, or peer matching. Say yes to yourself and say no to others, and I promise you that this is not a selfish act. And I encourage you to practice meditative exercises. One great meditative exercise that I definitely rely on is called box breathing. So if you think about inhaling through your nose and exhaling through your mouth, box breathing invites you to inhale for 4 seconds, hold for 4 seconds, exhale for 4 seconds, hold for 4 seconds, and repeat. Another great meditative exercise is the body scan. So I invite you to find scripts on Headspace, Calm, or YouTube, where a soft and calming voice can guide you through a full body scan. In addition, another meditative exercise that I love is guided imagery. Again, find these scripts on Headspace, Calm, or YouTube, where that calm and supportive voice can be guiding you through through a wonderful image, such as floating on a cloud or being at the beach. Additionally, considering how much information you want to share with family and friends is yet another form of self-care and alleviating stress. So I invite you to set boundaries. You and your loved one may want to disclose the diagnosis to only a few people, and please ask them to respect that this information that you're giving them is to remain private and confidential, if you want. Perhaps you as a caregiver need as much help as possible, in which case setting up help through online platforms such as My Cancer Circle, Lots of Helping Hands, or MealTrain could unite your friends and family to build a supportive and helpful community for you and your loved one. I also encourage caregivers to think about what brings them even the slightest bit of joy. And sometimes caregivers will note that traditions brought them joy, but that these cannot be maintained anymore. But I often challenge this by asking caregivers to consider how we could maintain these traditions. For example, if you and your loved one or your family take an annual beach trip, could you drive to your destination instead of flying if your loved one is immunocompromised? Or perhaps if decorating for a holiday was something you and your loved one looked forward to, how can we ensure that some decorations, if not all, are put up this year? Do we need to block out time on your calendar in order to do this? And if you and your loved one are unsure about an activity, never hesitate to ask the medical team for their input. You may be surprised, as they could tell you that certain activities are, in fact, safe. Lastly, I also want to take the time to acknowledge that long-distance caregiving can be as, if not more, difficult than short-distance caregiving. You may not know how exactly to help your loved one because you live so far away. You could experience feelings of guilt for not being physically present around your loved one. You may not be familiar with the local resources available for your loved one. And yes, you could even experience burnout symptoms, which are even valid for a long-distance caregiver and oftentimes do happen. But there are so many ways that you can still help as a long-distance caregiver. Set up a care for your loved one through, again, those online platforms such as My Cancer Circle, Lots of Helping Hands, MealTrain. Phone in when your loved one goes to doctor's appointments so that you can listen in on the conversation between the oncologist and your loved one. Research and set up practical and emotional resources for your loved one. And even just set up check-ins, very simple, with your loved one via FaceTime, text, or phone call. Remember, all forms of caregiving aren't easy, so please be patient with yourself. I always ask my caregiving clients to think about a couple of things when they feel most stressed. What are three admirable qualities that you have learned about yourself while caregiving? And lastly, honor the sacrifice that you have made for your loved one and reflect upon how your values may have changed or stayed the same over time. Thank you so much for allowing me to speak, and I will turn this back to Dr. Messner.
Oh, thank you so much, Ms. Smith. That was really just an outstanding presentation. Just so much thoughtfulness went into it and a lot of wonderful suggestions and tips for people. And actually, I just want to let everybody know that all of the resources that Ms. Smith mentioned, you will be getting a SurveyMonkey evaluation early next week. And in there, it's an evaluation of the program. But in addition to it being an evaluation of the program, we also include any resource that anyone mentioned. And even if we didn't mention it, we'll actually may include a resource that we may want to add as well. So just to be aware of that. So thank you so much. And I know the questions for you, Ms. Smith, during the Q&A. It was just a wonderful presentation. And our next speaker is Dr. Brian Kaufman. Dr. Kaufman is co-founder and executive VP and chief medical officer of the CLL Society, Inc. And he is going to be, he is a partner, the CLL Society, Inc. is a partner on today's program, and he is one of our, the speaker will be telling you about the CLL Society and its resources. And he'll be talking about the CLL Society, Inc. free programs and services and give you some specific programs that he'd like to highlight as well. So it's really my great pleasure to bring on my esteemed colleague, Dr. Hoffman. Dr. Kaufman.
Thank you for that kind introduction. For those who don't know us, CLL Society is an inclusive, patient-centric, physician-curated nonprofit that addresses the unmet needs of the CLL-SLL community through patient education, advocacy, support, and research. You never need to be alone at any time during your journey. We offer many free services to help you along the way. For example, on our website, clsociety.org, you can find 40-plus support groups that meet monthly through Zoom. Chances are good that you will meet other patients and care partners who've experienced what you're going through, and at a minimum are trained facilitators, often caregivers themselves, and other attendees can always offer friendship and practical advice. Care partners are always welcome at our group meetings, and you can reach out to support@cllsociety.org, that's support@cllsociety.org, to learn more about our caregiver-only group that is forming. Our website offers so much in patient and care partner-friendly terms, from the most basic explanation of the new terms that you're exposed to, such as what's a lymphocyte or what does the spleen do, to our practical and sometimes life-saving COVID action plan, to the groundbreaking news and research presented at important conferences and published in journals. We even have a whole section dedicated to caregivers. At least once a month, we have educational and supportive webinars, podcasts, Facebook Live events, and more. We offer no-cost virtual second opinions from world-class experts when you or your partner are facing a difficult decision. Just open CLLsociety.org and click on our expert access program to start the process of getting a consult. If you prefer to meet one-on-one, we have trained experts we can connect you with from our with our free one-on-one virtual session. We even have a non-denominational chaplaincy service that has usually been more about supporting your emotional and existential rather than your religious challenges facing CLL. We are constantly fighting for your rights with the FDA, CDC, CMS, Congress, insurance companies, in the pharmaceutical industry through our public policy and advocacy team. And because CLL is not a solved problem, we are funding research to, among other things, improve outcomes for all. Our motto is smart patients get smart care. You are already part of that smart patient movement by attending this session. CLL Society is here to augment your learning and support you at every stage of your CLL journey.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Kaufman. And indeed, the CLL Society is there for all of you every step of the way. And again, we will also be sending you all their contact information and the SurveyMonkey evaluations. You'll be able to reach out to them if you haven't already. I know some of you may already be contacted with him, but if you're not, of course, you'll want to. And I'm just going to say a few words about the resources of cancer care. And cancer care is a national nonprofit organization, and we provide a host of services. Many people contact our HOPE line, 800-813-4673, or some of our international participants, they want to visit our website at www.cancercare.org to get a sense of what the services are that we offer. I'm just going to say a few words about them. We have about 40 oncology social workers, and they answer the HOPE line, the telephone, when people call the 800 number. And basically, usually people call with a specific request. They may be calling for help with being a caregiver to someone with CLL, or for help with transportation of their loved one to treatment, the cost of that, or with food insecurity issues. And so the social worker does help them with those issues, and then we'll go over with them all the other services we offer. So what are those services? So we do offer financial assistance, practical assistance, and co-payment assistance, and also help with food insecurity. We also offer a number of online support groups for specific types of cancer, including CLL, as well as programs for caregivers, for young adults, older adults, partners, spouses, people living with CLL. So we offer a host of different programs on every type of cancer and also on different topics as well, coping with treatment side effects or caregiving. We offer those as well. In addition to that, we do offer about 70 or 80 of these programs per year, these workshops that we offer, these webcasts. And we also offer publications and fact sheets that you can access from our website. Just download the information. It's very current and very up to date. So that gives you just a thumbnail sketch of all the different services we offer. We also do offer resource navigation, which gives you a chance to actually, if we don't have the resource, we have a team of staff who will work with you until we get that resource that you need to be able to meet your need. And now we're going to move right on to the Q&A. And I'm going to ask Krista to explain to you how to queue up for questions.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we will take questions from the web only. You may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
So this is a question for Dr. Choi. Can you offer advice for caregivers and their loved ones with CLL on traveling? My husband and I took a flight last summer for vacation and ended up in the hospital because he caught something while traveling. He's scared to fly now, but doesn't want it to stop him from traveling. How can we do our best to make sure this doesn't happen again? If you could just comment on this for all of our participants, Dr. Choi, just some that might be helpful.
Yeah. No, thank you for that question. I agree that there's a reality that CLL and a lot of the CLL treatments, or all of the CLL treatments, affect the immune system. So your loved ones will be more vulnerable to infections. But I do think in most times, most days, most circumstances, one can still live a very full and practically normal life despite that. One doesn't have to stay home or kind of be very limited in their interactions. That said, yeah, these recent years, the coronavirus pandemic really kind of have been an exceptional time period that have kind of put a lot of others showed how significant immune compromise can be. So my thoughts are, this pandemic seems like it's kind of back. There have been times in the recent months where there have been many more cases, but also times where there have not been as many. Certainly this is hard to predict, but sometimes plans can be made, perhaps, or adjusted around times of kind of known surges. Certainly everything that we can do preventively, whether it's being up to date with vaccinations or talking to your medical teams, whether there might be a role for kind of preventive treatments like IVIG, or whether there are sometimes roles for even preventive antibiotics specific to various specific treatment regimens. I know that my team at UCSD, sometimes we will proactively prescribe kind of like a quote-unquote first aid kit to kind of take in your suitcase, oftentimes some sort of antibiotic that's more targeted towards sinus or respiratory infections, because that's kind of the more common thing that people are catching. But even that's not perfect, because a lot of what we catch on trips or even just around town are viruses that don't necessarily benefit from antibiotics. And probably in an ideal situation, the antibiotics wouldn't be given kind of blindly without knowing more what's going on. But you know, that can be one thing to have, just kind of a one extra level of protection if it's hard to get medical care on the road. So long way saying, I do think that we should still continue to plan on trips that are important and trips that bring joy and not feel like we can't do those things. But maybe there can be small things that can be done to optimize it, whether it's medications, ahead of time medications to bring with you, certainly wearing a mask and washing your hands frequently during the trip, and kind of just being aware of surroundings. If you're with people that you know and love, most of the people around you are people that would tell you if they're dealing with some potential illness and infection, then I think that should be okay. But perhaps if there are times where you're going to be surrounded by a lot of people that you don't know and wouldn't let you know if they might be coming down with something, maybe that's where keeping a mask on or trying to control those surroundings a little bit more can be helpful.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And I hope that helps both the participant asking the question, but all of the participants on the call today, to really work with your healthcare team if you're planning to travel in terms of any things that you should put in place to have a really a lovely trip. A question for Dr. Paulos. How can I be more involved in my father's medical appointments? I've started accompanying him when he goes to the hematologist-oncologist, but he doesn't speak up or mention any of the side effects he complains about to me. I want to bring them up to his doctor, but don't want to overstep. If you could just comment on this, Dr. Paulos.
Certainly. Now, that is a situation that many patients and caregivers experience, and the healthcare provider. So at the very beginning, what might be helpful, and it can be done at any time, actually, but at the beginning it helps the most, is to identify who is going to be the primary spokesperson, so to say. Who does the patient want to be able to get the information and then share the information with them as well as others? So, and as, at that time also, who's the another decision maker in addition to the patient? Autonomy, you know, is a big, and having some control are two big goals of our patients when they're going through this cancer experience. They really feel that they have no control and they lose their independence. So they may be reluctant for you to take over or to, you know, they're going to feel like you're taking over. But if you explain to them also during the conversation about who is going to be the decision maker, who's going to be the primary caregiver, you can ask, well, how do you want the questions to be handled? Would you feel better if I took care of them? Do you want me to make a list of them? You and I can both together come up with a list, and then you can ask them if you want, or if you feel that you don't want to say it, I'll be happy to bring up those questions. And yeah, I would think if you do it that way, it's shared decision-making, so they feel that they have some input. But one thing, do not feel like you're overstepping. If you're accompanying them, your loved one, your father, to appointments, then it's all right to ask questions. It's all right to bring up things. You know, many times patients are afraid to bring up side effects or other things that they think are negative because, one, and that we, different cultural groups don't want to hurt the provider's feelings because they're doing such a good job of everything else. Two, they feel if they talk about side effects, that means that perhaps their disease is progressing or perhaps this is not a good thing to be having side effects. And three, many patients still feel that they need to be stoic and, you know, that they can handle everything. So, again, do not feel like you're overstepping. Try to get involved in some shared decision-making. That list works. If you sit down and say, let's make up a list of questions, you'd be surprised how something as simple as that will really help facilitate communication, help you feel more comfortable in asking questions, and help your father feel like everyone is doing their best to take care of him. I hope that helped.
Excellent. Thank you so much. A question for Dr. Choi. My husband has had CLL diagnosis for 5 years. We are grateful for his doctor, but She isn't a CLL specialist. How important is it that my husband's doctor is a CLL specialist?
Thank you. No, that's a good question. Yeah, I know the CLL Society has kind of helped create an infrastructure where people can have access to people who focus more of their practice, clinical practice, on treating patients with CLL. And I think it can be helpful. You know, medicine's becoming so complex. There are new treatments every week, almost every day. There's something, some new development. And so it certainly is, I feel like, difficult for somebody to keep track of it all if their practice is very broad. I would say, though, that if the diagnosis, if the CLL is very stable, and that there are not symptoms, there are not decisions to be made regarding treatment, whether to start and which drugs to take, then there might not be a very tangible or specific benefit to seeing a specialist. But certainly, I think if your oncologist is coming now saying that there are decisions to be made or treatment that needs to be started, that might be the right time to ask them if they would be able to facilitate a referral to perhaps an academic center or center that has access to perhaps very promising drugs that might be in trials or drugs that recently have been approved. I would say, though, in the period where you're being monitored and kind of that active surveillance period, I would say sometimes the benefit of seeing a specialist would be more just kind of the continued dialogue and knowing what to watch for. And also sometimes it's really a true partnership. A lot of these CLL specialty centers are also very actively researching the disease and wanting to partner with you to learn more about how the disease progresses or how the disease may change. Not that they're going to be experimenting on you, but they'll be learning from you at the same time that they're watching you and treating you too.
Excellent, thank you. And for Ms. Smith, can you recommend any resources for caregivers to help understand medical jargon? I talk with my partner's doctor after appointments, but sometimes leave confused even after asking for clarification.
Yeah, absolutely. And this one is a tough one because sometimes this takes advocacy on our part, us meaning you as the caregiver, to speak up and say, I didn't quite understand that. What does that term mean? Or can you rephrase that? And it sounds like you are doing that, and that's still not working. And so what I would recommend is actually just asking the doctor, hey, could you draw me a picture of what's happening? Oftentimes, a visual is just much more easy to comprehend, and doctors usually are pretty willing to do it. I would also encourage you, if you are tempted to go on the computer, do not just do a random Google search because you don't know what types of websites have information that may not be true. So I recommend reputable websites such as CLL Society has a website, the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society has a website, Cancer Care. We also have helpful educational articles where you may be able to find some definitions to that medical jargon that you're confused about. But I would first start at the source and definitely ask your doctor, hey, could you maybe repeat that in layman's terms, or hey, could you please draw me a picture?
Excellent. Thank you so much. And I just want to remind everybody that our next CLL program is in 2 weeks from now, on June 26th, Managing Chronic Lymphocytic Leukemia, CLL, and its complications. So many of you may have signed up for it, but if you didn't, we'll be sending you a reminder about that as well. And for now, we're just going to do some takeaways from our speakers. And I'm going to ask, Dr. Palos to start as the first takeaway. Then Dr. Choi, and then Dina Smith. So Dr. Palos, do you want to go first?
Sure. Remember that effective communication with cancer patients and their caregivers can be achieved also if the healthcare members tailor their communication to the unique needs and characteristics of their patients. You know, we all need to remember there is no one-size-fits-all approach to meet communication needs, to talk about the important things, the disease, the treatment, the side effects, the emotional aspects of it, the sadness or the blueness, all of those. The key to all of that is effective communication and open communication. Do not be afraid to ask your questions. You know, again, I like the idea that Ms. Smith brought up about, ask your doctor to draw pictures. Just let them know, I don't understand. And if you feel the physician doesn't have the time or you don't want to take up their time, there's a whole team behind that physician or alongside that physician. So you can ask those individuals to help you clarify things that you don't understand. And I wish everyone on our call the best of luck in dealing with all of these issues. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Palos. Ms. Smith, do you want to comment?
Sure. So as I mentioned, caregiving can look and feel so different between each caregiver, even if a caregiver is taking care of a loved one, even if caregivers are taking care of loved ones with the same diagnosis. Their caregiving experiences are probably extremely different and extremely unique. So just know that no matter what type of caregiving that you're providing, it's probably more than enough, and you should be proud of that. In addition, please remember to reach out to friends and family if you feel comfortable doing so, because having their added support will just make you feel less stressed. It will alleviate stress, and it will also help give you back time to prioritize yourself. In addition, I also highly recommend that keep those traditions that you have always relied on in mind, because you never know. You may still be able to do them, talk with your doctor, but also get creative and think about how you can modify these traditions so that they're more accessible to you and your loved one. And finally, I encourage you to go on Headspace, Calm, and YouTube to find all those wonderful meditative exercises I was talking about, because they are truly very helpful. And I'll turn it back to Dr. Messner.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you. And Dr. Choi, your takeaways.
Yeah, no, this is such a meaningful discussion. I would say my takeaway is that the prognosis for our patients in CLL is improving, and treatments are getting better, but there still are ways that CLL is affecting people physically and emotionally, and the treatment itself can be complicated, both managing side effects and understanding the treatment course. So certainly having help from family and from loved ones is so important. I think there's certainly a great benefit from kind of being an extra set of eyes and ears and being there to help communicate questions and making sure that messages, that the information is being processed and understood at physician visits. I think just as much as, I guess that's my main takeaway. Sorry. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Choi. That was wonderful. And I have to say, this has been an extraordinary program today. I just want to thank all of our speakers. They've been phenomenal. And I also want to thank all of our participants. And although we've done a program on this before, this has probably been really the best of anyone we've ever done before. So I just want to, thank both our speakers and our participants for asking such great questions, and for our speakers for being such great, really providing such great content. Now, I do want to comment on the questions, because there are so many more questions than we could take just because there were so many of you on the call today. So for those of you who asked a question, for those of you who have a question that you'd like to ask or in queue to ask, and those of you who are thinking of another question, please go back to your treating healthcare team. They know you the best. They have access to your medical records. And you've also learned a lot from today's program. So please go back to your treating healthcare team and ask the questions that you asked today. And remember, your healthcare team does consist of your hematologist-oncologist, but also consists of oncology nurses, oncology social workers, patient navigators, financial navigators. So there's a whole slew of people who can actually assist you. And even if you ask your doctor a question, if it's not his area of expertise, he'll refer you to the person on their team who can help you. And there may be resources in the medical center where you're being treated that you may not know about that could actually be of tremendous help to you. So just to be aware of that. Also, I just want to thank all of you for your participation today. I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.